Welcome to Useful Idiots. I'm Matt Taibbi.
I'm Katie Halper.
This is our third show.
Very exciting.
Yeah, very exciting. We have a good show today. We're going to be talking to Jimmy Dore later on.
Yep, comedian. And host of the Jimmy Dore Show, yep.
Which is good because the theme of the show is going to be all about the news media and how it's been terrible of late.
Right, yeah.
And that's a topic that he is very strong on, so we're looking forward to talking to him later.
His spiel is like, I'm just a jack-off comedian. Why am I covering things that the rest of the media gets wrong?
He's got a lot to say about that, and there was a lot of interesting stuff in the news this week in terms of sort of failures of the press in both directions, left and right, so that's going to be interesting. So let's just get the news out of the way.
Sure, yeah.
Four food groups, what do we got?
For Republicans suck?
Yeah.
Sorry, we keep talking over each other because we're so excited.
Yeah.
So for Republicans suck, I chose to focus on Texas Governor Greg Abbott, who's defending new gun laws that ease restrictions on gun owners in that state Sunday. And of course, that was only hours after the laws went into effect and hours after a gunman shot at least 21 people, killing 7 in and around Odessa, Texas. So it was really nice timing. The Republican legislature followed up the mass shooting with some gun laws. But basically, it's 10 bills. I'm reading from Vox. A pro-gun agenda has enjoyed support within the Republican-majority Texas state legislature, where 10 bills became law at the end of the legislative session in June and were signed into law by Abbott shortly thereafter. These went into effect on Sunday. Taken together, these new laws allowed licensed gun owners to store firearms in a locked car in a school parking lot and ban private apartment buildings from prohibiting gun owners from storing their weapons in their rental units. They also make it easier for people to bring guns into houses of worship and allow some foster homes to store guns.
Well, I mean, I think people, while they're going to church, should be armed.
Yes,
I mean,
church,
so I'm
mosques,
fine with that.
Not church, mosques, and synagogues.
Right.
I forgot those. And also, just so you know, some background about this lovely gentleman, Abbott. In 2015, he tweeted, I'm embarrassed. Texas number 2 in nation for new gun purchases behind California. Let's pick up the pace, Texans.
So he basically wanted probably Texans to buy 5 times as many guns as Californians.
Or even
more, probably.
A man can dream.
Yeah, that's impressive.
Yeah.
Okay, for Democrats, like, it's not exactly Democrats per se. It's just more Democrat-leaning folk. We had our second sort of phony Trump boycott scare on the internet. Did you hear about this? The Olive Garden became the latest company to be subject to a Twitter boycott because some idiot on Twitter tweeted out that Olive Garden was supporting Donald Trump. So there were, you know, before the company knew it, there were 40,000 retweets of this thing calling on people to boycott Olive Garden. They had to come out with a statement saying that we don't support presidential candidates. And so this is the second time this has happened in over a month. Or earlier in the summer, there was a much bigger fiasco that involved Pizza Hut, Wendy's, McDonald's, Taco Bell, and some other fast food companies. And that one got like 270,000 retweets. So this whole thing with boycotts is becoming like a thing.
And then there was SoulCycle and Equinox.
High-end fitness brand Equinox Gyms got their members' heart rates racing in an entirely different way today. Criticism and threats to boycott the gym and its spinning studio, SoulCycle, came flooding in after word broke that the corporation's owner, billionaire Stephen Ross, is holding a lavish fundraiser for President Trump later this week.
There was a big call for boycott there.
Talk show host Andy Cohen raged outside a gym.
So Equinox and SoulCycle are giving our money to the Trump campaign.
But later added he was keeping his membership.
It's everybody's right to give money to whatever candidate they want.
So, okay, so that happened. So what happened in terms of, isn't that horrible for this week?
So isn't that horrible? I'm going to return to the Odessa shooting. It turns out a neighbor of the gunman told CNN that she reported him to police just last month after he threatened her with a rifle. But police never visited the house because guess why they didn't?
They didn't have enough, what, funding? I don't know.
They couldn't find it after it didn't show up on GPS.
The cops couldn't find the place?
Yeah.
So they were like millennial cops?
Yeah, I guess so. Right. Yeah. Yeah. Millennial cops. I mean, it's the one time like cops show restraint in shooting someone.
Right, because they can't follow directions.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly. It's horrible because it sounds like this actually was preventable.
Right.
And also, according to police, the gunman called 911 and the FBI national tip line shortly before he began shooting, but he didn't make any threats of violence.
He just said, I'm going to go out and...
I don't actually know. I don't think they reported on it, but they dropped the ball.
Okay, so they're going to have to send police now to remedial, like, living skills classes before they go out?
Imagine if they called the woman up and been like, hi, we can't find... I mean, it's embarrassing already, but, you know, you'd think that this would be important enough to maybe, like, call the woman back, be like, I can't find the...
It's going to be two lights, and you take a right.
Exactly,
The people can't really do that anymore.
Yeah.
That's terrible. Okay, well, for... Isn't that weird? You know, I know it's too big of a story for this normally, but the Epstein story, there are two things about this. First, they sent the two malfunctioning cameras outside of his cell to an FBI lab. That just seems like such a bizarre way to deal with that story. Like, what are they going to discover in terms of why the two cameras didn't work from laboratory analysis?
Right, like, that I think it wasn't, like, fiddled with or something? Is that what they're going to... I mean, is that...
And first of all, how is that judgment even going to be believed, no matter what happens?
Yeah.
And the second thing about this story is dead. Have you noticed that? It's not... It's really become a third or fourth year story in the press, and it was on the verge of being like the biggest story in history, like just a couple of weeks ago, and it's just suddenly nowhere.
What do you think happened?
I have no idea. I mean, I don't have any friends who are on that beat, so I don't understand it. But it seemed like everybody was gearing up to make this like a 6 or 9 month affair where they were going to cover it every day, and now the instant the suicide happened, it's like they've assigned people away from the story. It's very strange to me.
What beat is that? The perv who's really connected to very powerful
men? Yeah, I guess that. But are you a conspiracy theory person?
I mean, I find that term really annoying because it's so. First of all, there's conspiracy literally means what? More than
breathe
one person
together.
Doing something together, right?
Breathing together.
Oh, really? That's what it comes from?
Yeah.
Oh, speed ad. Yeah. Oh, I didn't even realize that. But okay, but legally, right? It means like more than one person doing something. So people say that's a conspiracy theory when things are conspiracies all the time.
Sure,
right? But the way it's used means it's like, are you a conspiracy theorist? It's like, do you believe in wacky, unproven things, right?
Right, yeah. Aliens taking over the Rothschilds or whatever it is.
No,
I mean, I always come from the point of view that most... kinds of corruptions are corruption or open conspiracies, right? Like, you know, sort of the subprime mortgage scandal, for instance. So something was right out in the open. It was a conspiracy between, you know, government, lack of law enforcement and that sort of thing. But it's very seldom do you see the kind of secret cloak and dagger, you know, the literary version of a conspiracy theory. That's very, very rare. Like, I'm always, like, you know, very reluctant to believe those stories when they pop up. But the Epstein thing, there's no way to make it make sense,
right?
You know, as a conventional corruption story, it's there's something about it that's really strange, and you would think that would be a thing that would attract, you know, every journalist on earth to cover the story, and for some reason, suddenly, no.
But isn't that part of, I mean, I don't know what the conspiracy theory is, but that also makes sense, right? If part of the conspiracy is that...
No, it's very weird. We should do a whole thing on that. That's another...
Next time. Sadly, we can't have Epstein on.
Well, we could. It just wouldn't be very interesting.
Right. It's true. Yeah. That's good. Yeah. Well, weekday with Epstein.
Right. Weekday with Epstein.
As we tape on Tuesday.
Hit him with the fly swatter.
Yeah,
that would be great. So who dropped out of the race this week?
Oh, yeah. We got to do our Crystal Lake update, right?
Yeah,
the body count. So we got Gillibrand, who dropped out. What do you have to say about that, Matt? What do you have to say about Gillibrand?
I don't have anything to say about Kirsten Gillibrand. Do you have anything to say about Kirsten Gillibrand?
I mean, she stumbled a lot during the last debate. I think I texted you. I was like, what was that? And you texted back, acid trip. because she definitely like just froze for a couple of seconds.
Do we have that audio?
Oh, yeah, we do.
Back significantly.
Senator Gillibrand, what's your response?
President Trump.
That was a unique debate moment. And there have been some bad debate screw-ups. I'm trying to think back in history. But I can't remember one where a person just literally is like, I got nothing.
Yeah, it wasn't a great moment.
Like, where was she doing?
I don't know. Was she like... texting some privileged
like
white women and telling them not to vote for
Trump.
That was her white privilege thing.
I kept trying to figure out during the campaign what the logic behind her candidacy was, and I couldn't figure out exactly where she was trying to slot in. It was very strange. Anyway, she's out now. So who do you think the next dropout
is? I'm hoping it'll be Buttigieg and Klobuchar. I don't think it will be, but those are the ones who I'd like to see gone.
I'll go with Bennett.
Bennett. You know, I went to Wesleyan, and his father was the head of Wesleyan.
Really?
Yeah. Doug Bennett. He talked like his son if his son had a mouthful of marbles.
He already kind of talks like that.
Well, even imagine more marbles.
So it was like two mouthfuls of marbles?
Yeah. What's the two mouthfuls of marbles.
Yeah. The thing is, he serves a purpose in the race as being somebody that they can use to beat down the progressives with, like, you know, what do you think about Bennett's plan?
Right.
Yeah.
I think they should just count Bennett, Delaney,
Bullock.
They should just count them as one. Well, they're not in the debate anymore.
Like a three amigos thing?
Yeah, the three centrist, moderate, boring amigos.
Yeah.
And then throw Klobuchar in there too.
That would be a good movie concept, actually.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so this was a really bad week for the news media. There were two pretty sort of hairy news media. Scandal is kind of a strong word, but there were two flubs. They're worth talking about in some depth because they represent two different species of complaint that people have about the news media generally. And this is why we're doing this kind of media sucks themed podcast. But the one that got a lot of attention, especially on progressive Twitter last week or on the social media, involved the Bernie Sanders fact check. Now, there's a fact check column in the Washington Post. And first of all, fact-checking columns are a relatively new craze. I mean, they've always existed, but in the Trump era, they've suddenly assumed this new importance, and it's part of the media's self-image. You know, this democracy dies in darkness thing, that we're the protectors of fact. There are all these fact-checking sites, online, PolitiFact, et cetera, et cetera. The Post is really into this whole thing, and they did a fact check of something that Bernie had said, which was talking about how 500,000 people go into bankruptcy every year because of medical costs, so they're medical related bankruptcies. And the Post did this whole fact check that was based on the fact the stat came from a study that was done by this guy named David Himmelstein, and it was published in the American Journal of Public Health. And there's a bunch of things about this that are crazy. First of all, the Post had itself cited that same statistic in an earlier piece. So clearly the fact was checked well enough for its own publication previously. But what they did with this is they went into the whole methodology of Himmelstein's study, and they looked at how he had come up with the 500,000 number, which was based on the idea that he had sent out surveys to a large number of people who had gone into bankruptcy and asked them whether it was very true or somewhat true that their bankruptcy had been related to medical costs, right? And they concluded essentially that he was overrating the impact of medical costs on bankruptcies, despite the fact that Himmelstein pretty conclusively laid out his numbers. He may even have been undercounting because we were talking about 500,000 households essentially, right? So it could have been as many as 2 million people. But they drilled down so far just to get under the skin of that one number. And I think what people don't understand is this is not the way fact-checking works. Like, I've been fact-checked a gazillion times in my life. When you go through, a long feature, and you have too, I'm sure, right? You're not trying to flunk people who are submitting an article, or this would be a political speech, but you're just looking for the idea that it's a defensible number, a defensible claim that's submitted by some kind of authoritative person, right?
Yeah.
And that you have one or two sources who will sign off on it. And that's enough to get the fact through to otherwise, think about it. You could never pass an entire newspaper or something like that. So they drilled down so far just to bent over backwards to flunk this fact. They gave Sanders three Pinocchios for this stupid Geppetto rating, whatever that is.
Yeah. I know.
And then after that, they're like, the guy isn't peer reviewed. They get a letter back from them saying it is peer reviewed, and they still won't admit that they made a mistake. They won't retract it. And I don't know. This to me was really interesting because this was an instance where it's an incredibly petty thing. It's not important in the larger scheme of things, but in the given that they've done so much negative stuff about this one candidate, the fact that they can't even retract a clear mistake like this, it just sends a message to a huge number of people that the paper's just not going to be responsive to a certain demographic. And
and it's also like the fact that they went after him on this level for this mistake in the first place is it's almost like showing their hand so much. It's almost, I guess it should surprise me, but it doesn't. Or it should not surprise me, but it does. It shouldn't surprise me because the Washington Post is so biased. But they just wear it on their sleeve so much. Like, this is so blatant. But I guess because they're dinner party circuit, they all hate Sanders.
In this particular kind of species of media person, you know, sort of Washington,
right.
New York, L.A. corridor of, you know, sort of national journalists, they you know, Bernie's disliked.
Right.
Which I get. I mean, there are politicians I dislike. But to do this, is so, it's just so petty. You know,
yeah. It's just a window into what they do all the time,
right?
On a more subtle level, right, or less obvious level.
Well, they've done so many, like,
the famous.
There was that day they did the infamous 16 stories in 16 hours or whatever it was, yeah, about Sanders, and some of those stories were preposterous. And this whole thing was so crazy because they had a back and forth with Himmelstein, the researcher. You know, they went into this whole explanation of whether or not he was peer-reviewed.
Oh, my God, yeah, this is really
which
pathetic.
Was, Himmelstein actually wrote to them and basically said, look, it was peer-reviewed.
Right.
And he shows a picture of the note to him, you know, "Dear Mr. Himmelstein, your thing has been accepted for peer review."
Right.
Right. And that's from the journal, right? And the journal, Glenn Kessler writes,
who's the head of fact-checking.
Head of fact-checking there. So this is false. Article did not say it was not peer-reviewed. We quote an editor saying the, quote, editorial did not undergo the same peer-reviewed editing process as a research article, but note it used the methodology similar to what the researchers used in a 2005 peer-reviewed study. I mean, I do this for a living. I have no idea what that means.
Yeah.
I mean, if you talk to an academic, yes, some of them I've talked to have said, I do kind of vaguely understand what they're saying, that this is a peer-review-like process that he underwent, but it wasn't technically a peer review. But for them, what they're saying is, we're not saying it's not peer-reviewed, but it isn't peer-reviewed. It just went through a process that's like peer review. It's like triple speak, you know?
Yeah.
And again, with fact-checking, you want to make a simple call. Is this peer-reviewed or not, you know?
Right. And it was in the American Journal of Public Health, which is not like some weird fringe journal.
Yeah, it's not Screw Magazine.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That would make it very interesting. But no, so this Dr. Himmelstein, this MD, wrote to Salvador Rizzo, who's the, I guess, this individual fact checker who went after Sanders on this. Glenn Kessler is the director of, or whatever, the head editor of it, right? So this poor doctor writes to Rizzo, "Your Washington Post fact checker article falsely claimed that my article in the American Journal of Public Health had not undergone peer review, while some other editorials that appear in that journal may not undergo such review. As indicated in the email included below that I received from the editor-in-chief of the journal, mine clearly did. Your false claim has besmirched my reputation as a scholar. I demand that you immediately publicly retract it and the rest of your article, and that you pursue vigorous efforts to inform your readers of your error." So this isn't just about Sanders either, right? It's like
no,
the
it's
collateral
about the guy,
damage.
Right.
Is,
yeah. First they say that Sanders is lying, right? Then they go on to say that Himmelstein
right,
is lying.
Yeah.
And then later, the journal actually, right, the guy, Himmelstein includes a letter from the journal that says, "Dear David, I have confirmed to the Washington Post that your letter was peer-reviewed. There has been some confusion here because they approached us with a general question about editorial signed Alfredo Morabia, editor-in-chief." So then the Post doesn't retract it even after then. So now they're saying Sanders and Himmelstein and the American Journal of Public Health are all mistaken.
Right, right. And these fact checkers clearly know what they're talking about, and it's not the Journal of Public Health.
And they're checking the fact that the American Journal of Health peer-reviewed the study, and the journal says they did, and they're like, yeah, whatever. They still don't retract it.
Yeah, why shouldn't they retract their own story that cited this?
Well, yeah, you would think.
We should have a list where we just assume. I honestly, it's so infuriating how entitled and unaccountable these people are. We should just start saying that they've apologized and retracted it and corrected it. And then if that's not true, they're going to have to step forward and say that. But we should have a list. So Washington Post, yeah.
We should do a fake news story.
Yeah. So Washington Post.
Thank you to the Washington Post for retracting that story.
Right. And also thank you for apologizing for your systemic bias against Sanders and your...
And Dr. Himmelstein.
And Dr. Yeah. Himmelstein, yeah.
Yeah. The thing that's really frustrating about this, if you go through fact-checking and you get a letter from somebody who's in your story and you have a factual mistake in your story, and they are writing to you, a person who is in a position to sue you for libel, and they have proof that you've done something mistaken. Every editor, worth his or her salt in the industry would be like, okay, let's fix it, because why bother? Like, right. there's no upside to leaving a mistake. This shows you how the extent that they're willing to dig in on this issue. It shows you exactly where they are with respect to this candidate, because if it were any other situation, it's just not worth it normally.
Right. Yeah. It should be embarrassing, but they don't really have the conscience required to be embarrassed.
You know, this gets to the whole, the thing that Sanders was talking about before, where he was complaining about the Post and saying that, what do you expect? Jeff Bezos, owns the Post, and I've gone after Amazon, and Sanders had this big public confrontation with them, and which resulted in the company and Bezos's company having to raise their minimum wage to $15 an hour. Of course there's going to be some kind of sort of negative slant in the paper. And there was a cacophony of responses from journalists saying that's ridiculous, that's a conspiracy theory. People went on CNN to talk about this, which is totally absurd, right? I mean, you know how it works in the press, right?
We have video. Can we play the video?
Sure.
Oh, by the way, really quickly before we do that, I just wanted to say that Glenn Kessler, the fact checker, right? He tweeted casually recently, why do I always have to turn down the sound when Bernie answers? Like, why do you say that? You just email that to your nerdy friends, like your fellow, like your Washington Post Slack.
Right.
But why would you say that?
Washington Post line.
Yeah. Imagine being a fact checker and just saying that stuff.
This was an issue in the last campaign in 2016, and it was one of the reasons that Liz Spade, had to quit as the public editor of the New York Times, because she got into trouble for saying, it's not always a good thing for reporters to have Twitter presences, or at least it's different than it used to be. Like in the old days, if you had a byline in a newspaper, nobody knew what your politics were. They didn't know what you thought. And that was, in some respects, a good thing. Like, not everybody in the business is like a snarky, columnist like, you or me, right? And that anonymity was really valuable to news organizations because it gave them some legitimacy. But now everybody has a Twitter presence, so you know where everybody stands and everything. But the last person you want to have opinions is the fact checker.
Right. And it's almost, it's refreshing in some ways because it's so transparent.
Right.
Like his claims of objectivity are so undermined by this. But it's disturbing, not just that he has those opinions, but it's disturbing that he feels comfortable doing that.
Right.
So let's watch CNN.
The Washington Post is pushing back at criticism from Senator Bernie Sanders. The 2020 Democratic hopeful blasted the Post coverage of his campaign. And he argues that it is biased because it is owned by Amazon CEO Jeff Bezos. Listen to Sanders in New Hampshire yesterday.
Anybody here know how much Amazon paid in taxes last year?
Yeah.
See, and I talk about that all of the time. And then I wonder why the Washington Post, which is owned by Jeff Bezos, who owns Amazon, doesn't write particularly good articles about me. I don't know why.
He failed to provide any evidence of that. Those past comments along those lines were echoed by his campaign and prompted this reply by Marty Baron, the executive editor for The Washington Post. Quote, Senator Sanders is a member of a large club of politicians of every ideology who complain about their coverage. Contrary to the conspiracy theory that the senator seems to favor, Jeff Bezos allows our newsroom to operate with full independence, as our reporters and editors can attest.
From the Marty Baron.
I can't, that kills me, that
part. He was played by Liev Schreiber in Spotlight. How can we criticize
him? Yeah, I do like Schreiber. But that is the most ridiculous thing.
And when you're going against such a standard like the Washington Post, which has come out and said from Marty Baron himself that you are perpetuating a conspiracy that sounds just like the President of the United States.
You're like, it's such a conspiracy that even the publisher.
I mean, it's preposterous. If somebody said, if you worked for Fox News, nobody's going to say anything bad about Rupert Murdoch. There isn't a single, Democrat or progressive in the world who would argue with that. It's a self-evident statement.
Right.
And everybody knows that that's how it works. In this, nobody comes down and red pencils
your
copy.
Right, which we'll talk about.
Yeah.
But, I mean, on top of that, imagine if your defense of that was like, even Rupert Murdoch said it's not true. Like, why does she think this is a good argument? It's the exact opposite of a good argument. It's like, that's the last person you quote. You'd say even this objective person who has nothing to do with this, or even this person who loves Sanders, or even this person who hates the Washington Post. But no.
If you're going to make that accusation, you better be able to offer some proof. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, you are acting just like Donald Trump. I'm sorry.
But.
Okay, so.
The Trump thing, if you criticize the media, you're Trump. That's a faulty syllogism. Yeah. Like, you ever see that you heard the Woody Allen joke? Like, Socrates is a man, all men are mortal, therefore all men are Socrates.
That's exactly what they're saying. Yeah.
You know, Donald Trump criticizes the media, Bernie Sanders, therefore Bernie Sanders is Donald. It doesn't work that way. Like,
no.
Just because Donald Trump does something doesn't make all criticism of the media
invalid. It doesn't
make
it Trumpian, per se. And also, look what the way they're criticizing it. Like, Sanders isn't saying anything threatening. He's not making fun of journalists for, like, being disabled, right? Like, the fact that you could compare those things. I mean, I remember seeing this a lot in 2016 with TPP. People were like, oh, they both oppose TPP.
Right.
Like, well, you know who else opposes TPP? The Sierra Club. Doctors Without Borders, Feminist Majority Now, all these groups that the liberals who are making that argument claim to support. Like, there is overlap. Politics makes for strange bedfellows.
Yeah,
you know, people support things for different reasons. And is Noam Chomsky Trumpian with all of his critique of the media?
Right,
manufacturing
exactly.
consent,
right.
Trump's mind comp or whatever.
And the thing about this, and I think Jimmy is going to get into this a little bit too, the whole issue, when they get up there and they say, oh, you know, who owns the newspaper doesn't have any impact on our coverage, or, you know, who advertises on our channel doesn't have any impact on how we cover things. Everybody knows that's bullshit.
Right.
Look, I've worked for news organizations that have come up against the problem of criticizing an advertiser before.
Right.
Like, it comes up,
right.
and beyond that, it on an unconscious level, that's where it works. It works at the point of hire. You know that if you start being a jerk about certain things, you're not going to get promoted
right.
in this company.
And you
that's
wouldn't have been hired
works.
In the first place, right? And then
exactly.
once you get there, yeah, it's not all overt.
And that's
right.
why people like Jennifer Rubin and Max Boot rise to the op-ed page, and, you know, and the Glenn Kesslers of the world will do fine. The point is, denying all this just completely undermines the credibility of
right.
the press with huge swaths of the public, left and right.
Wow, you know? Wow, Matt, you sound like Trump.
Exactly.
Wow,
yeah,
saying
yeah.
that there's and the same people who are making this point are like people who accuse the press of being biased against Hillary Clinton.
Oh, right, yeah.
You know?
I mean, it's all in the eye of the beholder, right? I mean, like, bias exists everywhere, and it's just a question of, like, how upfront you are about
exactly.
it. It's the denying it that makes
right,
it difficult,
exactly,
you know?
Right.
So.
Totally.
And then we get into the sort of the other example of
the false equivalency.
Yeah, or you know, how you can hurt your credibility is the thing that happened with Lawrence O'Donnell last
yes,
week.
Oh, yes, right.
So Lawrence O'Donnell, in the middle of like the transfer over to Rachel's show, right? Or
it was
the other way around. Yeah, exactly. He comes up with
it.
This, you know, a scoop.
Hmm. This single source close to Deutsche Bank has told me that Donald Trump's loan documents there show that he has co-signers. That's how he was able to obtain those loans. And that the co-signers are Russian oligarchs.
What? Really?
That would explain, it seems to me, every kind word Donald Trump has ever said about Russia and Vladimir Putin, if true. And I stress the if true.
And it's funny, watch Maddow, who's not exactly a skeptic when it comes to Russiagate allegations and Trump conspiracy theories. She's like, I mean, she looked like disturbed, shocked, incredulous,
right.
like, what's going on?
Yeah, but it was a big story, right?
Yeah,
I mean,
and
I should say, I don't necessarily disbelieve it. It's possible, you know? I mean, look, Donald, there's been reporting in the past that suggested that he's had Russian financing. You know, it's a natural marriage,
mm-hmm.
you know, an American real estate baron
right.
with Russian
Marty
money,
baron.
Right?
Conspiracy. Yeah.
So the idea that he would have Russian financing, there's nothing that's unbelievable about that. But they didn't have the story, right? As it turns out.
Last night on this show, I discussed information that wasn't ready for reporting. I repeated statements. A single source told me about the president's finances and loan documents with Deutsche Bank, saying if true, as I discussed the information, was simply not good enough. I did not go through the rigorous verification and standards process here at MSNBC before repeating what I heard from my source. Had it gone through that process, I would not have been permitted to report it. I should not have said it on air or posted it on Twitter. I was wrong to do so.
So I guess what makes this stand out is that he actually copped to it.
Exactly. Right? Exactly. And this is, if this had happened a year ago, we would barely have even noticed this story because this was happening routinely
right.
at the time. And it's a feature of kind of the modern media landscape because the business model now is so divided. So we have networks that basically cater to people who identify as Democrats or blue staters, and then we have Fox on the other side and right. the Daily Caller and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So it's the, you know, because it's divided like that, what tends to happen is if you do a story and you screw it up, the retraction is going to appear on the other side.
Right.
In other words, like the New York Times is going to do a story. If they get something wrong, it's going to be the Daily Caller that points it out.
Right.
And
not the retraction,
versa.
The rebuttal, right?
The rebuttal, yeah. Well, sometimes it's not really a retraction. It's just like that story turned out not to be true, right?
Right, but it's the other side saying it.
It's the other side will say it. So, you know, for an example, there were so many of these Russia stories in the last couple of years that kind of like went sideways after they were released. Like the New York Times did a huge kind of narrative driving story. Like Trump campaign had repeated contacts with Russian intelligence. And later on, you know, James Comey was testifying and he like, you know, in congressional testimony says that story is not true. But the Times didn't retract the story. It was discussed in conservative media.
Right.
And that happens the other way, too. Like, you'll see false stories
right.
or stories go sideways on Fox or in conservative media. And then it's we talk about it on
right.
the other side.
Right. And then if you mention the thing that, let's say, MSNBC or New York Times got wrong, then you're Trumpian, or you're repeating right-wing talking points, or you're repeating...
Or defending Trump or something like that.
Right,
yeah,
right. Or why are you parroting a right-wing site?
Right.
It's like, well, we don't want to be. That's kind of the point. If
right.
only, like, the left actually retracted stuff, then we wouldn't have to be citing these sites because it would be covered here.
Right. When you have a divided landscape like this, what ends up happening is people sort of implicitly understand that everything's politicized, right? And if they see that you're not retracting your own screwed up stories, they just don't believe you. Like if you even if they like what you're saying. And so this is a huge problem. And this is one of the things we're going to talk about with Jimmy, which is you think about the way the media is organized right now. You take a company like MSNBC, they're or the Washington Post. Let's take the Washington Post for example. They're dumping on the Sanders voters, right? And they're basically telling them, we're not going to listen to your complaints. Like, they're not valid enough for us to do a retraction. But they're also dumping on the Trump people at the same time. So who's their target audience? 25% of the public now? Or is it less than that because a portion of the public doesn't vote? Like, isn't that
right.
weird? I mean, you know.
Yeah.
And this is a totally different business from what it used to be when, you know, we were trying to have credibility across the board.
Right.
Right?
Yeah.
I mean, what's really distressing about all this is that I think a lot of the people in the business who have kind of watched this happen over time, it's like being frogs in boiling water. They haven't realized how bad it looks
right.
to the outside, right? And so when
they're so insular.
When you make repeated mistakes and you don't retract them or you don't admit that you've done it, over time, like, you know, it becomes completely transparent to even unsophisticated audiences that you got a problem. But within that bubble, it's such a bubble now.
So speaking of media bias and irresponsible media and the false equivalency, let's play our interview that we did with Jimmy Dore.
This is a really fun interview. Jimmy at one point gets so wound up that I actually was speechless just watching him during this chat. It was really fun. So tune in now.
We're really excited to be talking to Jimmy Dore, a comedian, host of The Jimmy Dore Show. Welcome.
Well, it's amazing how you can feign excitement like that.
I mean,
she really
I am
sold
excited.
That, didn't
Sorry.
You?
I'm so drunk.
Really excited?
I'm so, you're going to have to do the opening, whatever. Hey! Hey!
Oh, hi, Katie.
Is that good?
How are you, Katie?
Good. How are you?
It's good to see you. Did a great
you
job
too.
on the show.
Thank you. Yeah, I did Jimmy's show. It was great. And, you know, I have to say, something really moving about your show at the end of the show. And Jimmy's a comedian, obviously, he's really funny. But at the end of your show, you actually were started everyone in the room chanting, "All wars are bullshit."
Correct.
And it was really moving. I have to admit, I like couldn't chant along with it because I was afraid I was going to cry. It was, but I was like, oh my God, it's so rare to hear this. And I thought that was kind of a great example of your purpose. You're very funny. You're very angry. But you really do have a very important message that's actually, as corny as it sounds, it's very pro-human. Like, you actually like people, as angry as you come off. And, mm-hmm. and you're angry because you like people. So.
That's right.
Can you describe for us what your show is? Like, how do you describe your show? Because it is an interesting combo of different things.
So I like to describe my show as what The Daily Show would be if it wasn't hosted by a millionaire and produced by a giant corporation.
Is that where you got the concept? Were you watching The Daily Show and thinking, this is how I would do it if I had a...
So I was... it all started in 2006. The UCB Theater opened in Los Angeles, and they asked me if I would do a show. And at the time, I had hurt my back, so I was watching a lot of TV news, and I just couldn't get over it. I couldn't get over how bad it was. I couldn't get over it. And I wanted to show everybody. And so when they asked me to do that show, I was like, I know what I'll do. I'm going to just show video clips of the news, and people are going to freak out. So it was right when, you know, The Daily Show was huge. And he, you know, Jon Stewart pioneered that kind of genre of video, how to use it. And so I learned a lot from watching him and whatever, but there's a lot to it, using video in a live setting. And so it took a while for me to figure out how to do it right and correctly. And that's all started at the UCB Theater when I started doing it was a show called Poppin' Politics, which led to my hour special on Comedy Central, which was called Citizen Jimmy. And that led to me then getting on The Young Turks, which then led to the Jimmy Dore Show.
What was the first material that you were doing?
From what I remember, it was just about the ridiculousness of the news going along with the Iraq war and stuff like that. So now people pretty much get it. But still, people turn to MSNBC as like it's some kind of alternative news programming yeah. instead of being produced by the exact same people that they're supposed to be. That's the theme of my show, is that the problem with the news is that they're owned and funded by the people they're supposed to be investigating and exposing. And of course, you're not going to get the news that you need to know about from those people, which is why we're in 8 wars that nobody gives a shit about. 80% of the people live paycheck to paycheck. 50% Americans can't afford like a $400 emergency. 30 million Americans don't have health. I mean, that's because the people who bring us the news are all owned by the people who want to keep that status quo. I mean, that's not anything new, but it's for really rare to hear for right. some reason, even in comedy. You know, right now it's kind of a sad time for comedians. Because they've been sucked into this Russiagate bullshit, and instead of debunking it and standing up to Red Scares, they play right along with it. Every late night talk show, first of all, there's no even reason for those shows to exist. Who the hell would go home? So I was watching Conan O'Brien the other day, just for, you know, not the right reasons.
Right.
And
were you high?
So yes. Right. So they announced Andy Richter's podcast. He has a new podcast. And I was like, wow, maybe they'll talk about something interesting on that podcast, because they never fucking talk about anything interesting on this 22-minute show he does a night, which is why podcasts are big now. Why would you go watch that show when you can watch, you know, someone speak interestingly? Joe Rogan outdoes all of them.
Right.
Joe Rogan, the host of Fear Factor, who announced this guy's fighting in cages,
right.
is a better talk show host than all these millionaire, zillionaire guys.
And also, he and you... You have more reach now than... Are you amazed? I'm always amazed that people in the business are not aware of how little impact they're having as opposed to what they used to have. I mean, people like you and Joe, you're actually bigger media properties now, really, than a lot of these cable outlets.
Well, it's because they can get something, you know, from us that they can't get anywhere right. else. You know, people want to have funny, interesting conversations about politics. They turn on Bill Maher. They're getting corporate claptrap that isn't insightful one bit. That show, you know. So, I am surprised when powerful people recognize me publicly. Like when Neera Tanden, who's the president of the Center for American Progress,
we're big
Neera fans, yeah.
came at me on Twitter. It was like, oh, I thought you were going to pretend to not notice me
right.
your whole life.
Right.
But it's bothering her so much that I outed her for the fascist war criminal that she really is, because she got revealed by WikiLeaks that she wanted to steal the oil in Libya. She was advocating for stealing their oil so we could fund more interventionist wars, because right. if we don't, we're going to have to cut social programs yeah. at home. And that would piss people off. So in order to keep being able to do these foreign wars, we better start stealing their oil. That was Nirritanen revealed by Julian Assange, and now she's advocating for his imprisonment and death, right? And so I just called out, no, you're the real fascist. So the fact that I do a video that she watches, and then she actually tweets about it. It's like, oh my God.
Thanks for the PR.
I'm a drunk nightclub comedian who smokes pot in the morning in my garage, and it's bothering these people. Why? Because there is no adversarial journalism in this goddamn country, and it's up to people like me. Right. And that's why our country's in such a bad shape, when it lands on the shoulders of people like me to be the anti-war voice.
Right.
You know, it's we're in a sad state of affairs.
And of course, she tweets like, when Jimmy Dore harasses me, I just ignore it. Cut to her tweeting about Jimmy Dore allegedly harassing her. It's like an interesting way of ignoring it. How many? She's like 90,000 followers or something.
Yes,
and she's got a whole network of trolls that
Oh my god! Yeah, right. Yeah, yes.
It's not just her.
Yeah, we should do a game like Guess That Troll. Name which Neera troll it is.
Yeah, no.
I mean, look how bad it is. Sirius XM has a progressive news channel, which is the opposite of a progressive news channel.
Run by Zerlina Maxwell, Hillary Clinton.
Who's the most anti-progressive person in the world. She hates Bernie. She lies about him publicly. She's caught and outed. And by the way, doesn't hurt her. She doesn't, because when you lie at the behest of the establishment, there's never a price to pay.
Yeah.
Ever.
You fail upwards.
That's right.
Fail forward. Yeah. No, she's, I don't know if you remember this. One of her greatest hits of dishonesty was when she just said that she clocked it, and Sanders, during his kickoff speech in Brooklyn, didn't mention race or gender until 20-something minutes in. And people were like, wait, he's literally on, like, he's on film mentioning these things 5 minutes in. Like, I feel like liars used to be better at it, but I guess it's this entitlement and this impunity that lets them actually say things that are totally debunkable.
In this media environment, I think the Russia story is a great example. Just keep going forward. Just keep saying the next thing, and the news cycle will never catch up to it.
Right? Exactly. That's exactly right. And someone, I forget who, made the analogy that in the West, in the old West, when they would form a posse, they would always bring a couple extra horses for when their horse got tired, they would just jump on the other horse. And that's what Russiagate turned out to be. That they just, oh, really? So there's no Russiagate? Well, we're going to jump on the obstruction horse, and we're just going to keep riding it, and without taking a breath.
Right.
And we're just going to keep going. And so that's what I thought. I thought, you know, I was hanging on. I thought the Mueller report was going to set everything straight, right? And I was at the Young Turks at the time, and they were...
Well, it's kind of like an abusive relationship. Like, you keep hoping that there's going to be a breakthrough, right? You're like, it's going to change now. Once we see this with the Mueller...
If I just do good work, if I just keep my head down and keep doing good work...
Yeah.
I don't put my head down, but I do keep doing good work and screaming it at the top of my lungs. Maybe everything will turn out good.
That's not how
it works.
Right.
People have no idea how unnews the news is.
Right.
I mean, there's also the issue of people, when they watch the news, they don't realize they're watching a consumer product. You know, the other thing that drives me. People, they're just telling the truth. You know, look, do you think it's a public service that they're doing? I mean, this is a money-making corporation, right? I mean, there's a profit incentive in terms of every piece of content that you see.
Worse, it's the people in the business, right? The people who consider themselves journalists, who have no idea how they've been groomed for that job since they were in kindergarten. Right. Because if they thought us a different way, I was at some kind of meeting in San Francisco, a bunch of journalist types, and I always get uncomfortable around those people. And I was on a panel, and there was a guy, regular journalist guy, award winner guy. And he always likes to start off, well, you're not a journalist. Right. That's what he says to me. And I'm like, well, did you go to school for journalism? You got your degree? And of course he didn't.
Right.
He's like, of course, me neither. We're exactly the same. All journalism is taking your head down the street and seeing what's happening. That's called journalism. And they can't even fucking do that.
Right.
And so when he's like, you know, when we're in these editorial meetings talking about war, you know, we don't talk like that. We don't talk like you think we talk. And I go, well, isn't it amazing that every news organization is always for every war, even though you guys don't have secret meetings? How does that happen? Right. How does that happen? That's because you're chosen, just like broadcast news. Have you guys not known how this works? You're chosen. Guys like me are not chosen to work for companies like yours, and if they do, they fire my ass. They fire Chris Hedges when he told the truth about the Iraq. They fired Phil Donahue. They fire Ed Schultz just for covering Bernie Sanders, and people still turn into MSNBC as if they're getting the news. And Rachel Maddow and Chris Hayes didn't quit when that happened.
Jesse Ventura, they unhired him. He's still living in a house
Casa
he calls
Casa MSNBC.
Casa MSNBC that he paid for with the money that they had to pay him for the
his contract.
Yeah, exactly. So
and people think that's the news. And then those news people When you actually do the news or you say something truthful about a war, like I do, they'll smear you.
Right, that's the other thing, yeah.
And they make you, just like they do to Tulsi, they make you feel icky.
Yeah.
About when, I think I heard you say that, actually.
Yeah, no, yeah.
That's the point of propaganda, is to make you feel icky when their name comes up.
Yeah, you create an ick factor around somebody, exactly. And people who are afraid to associate with that person, retweet, anything like that.
I've said this before, there's a visceral feeling you get when someone you know is smeared, or someone you retweet is smeared, or someone you've had on your show is smeared. I get it, at least, and I've said this on Twitter. And I say it because I want people to know that there is this pressure that people feel. Like, I think that people don't get it. There really is, like, the ick factor works, even when you know mm-hmm. that it's wrong. Like,
yes.
The difference is whether or not you give into it, but right. It's there. There is this collective pressure. And we were just saying how people say the same thing again and again, and they lie and lie. And it really, the other part of that is, for that to work, you do have to smear people, and you have to have this ick factor, so that reason and facts is kind of outweighed by those other things, right?
Of course.
That's what lets you ignore the reasons and facts, because you're in this emotional zone where it's like, oh, this person, you know, they're just a bad person. Like facts aside, you know, this person's just an Assadist, an apologist. And then you don't have to look at the content, right? Which is what we saw with Kamala Harris and Tulsi Gabbard. As long as you employ a smear, that trumps everything else. And you get that a lot.
I just was called racist because I won't have Andrew Yang on my show, who I had on my show.
Oh, yeah.
Of course, I've had him on. We talked for like an hour. It's a weird thing to see people weaponize. That's the term, right? Weaponize identity politics.
Yeah.
That's what that's called,
yeah.
Right? It's weird to be the victim of that and see people do it so disingenuously and do it. Like, to accuse someone of being a racist falsely, to me, is, I don't know if it's as bad as actually being a racist, but it's certainly just as immoral.
So I have a question for you about your political evolution. You said, like, in 2006, you were doing stuff at UCB. You were already aware of the MSNBC stuff, the MSNBC bias, right?
Right.
Did you go?
But
kind
I still
of,
like. But that's when they went and got Keith Olbermann. So I'm like, well, maybe they'll be good,
right?
And, you know, and I was really a big Keith Olbermann fan at that time. Like a lot of people were. Also sad to see what happened.
I mean, I know that I will look back at things that I wrote and said, and I kind of cringe. But did you have an evolution where you were more like...
Yes.
So can you talk about that?
The big moment for me was when I read Listen Liberal by Thomas Frank.
Right.
So, yeah. I mean, I was always lefty and whatever, and, you know, pulling for MSNBC. And
right.
I always thought it was a left-right paradigm. I always thought it was left-right.
Yeah.
And
Democrats
and
Republicans too?
Yes.
Or okay,
and I
yeah.
couldn't understand Republican. I couldn't understand right wing. I don't get, you know, Ben Mankiewicz used to always say, you know, you can't even talk to these people because it takes 80% of your time just to unwind the crazy, right?
Yeah.
And I felt the same way. Well, I feel that way about Russiagaters now.
Right, right?
You can't
exactly.
even talk to them. So that's when I realized, oh, it's not left-right. It was Listen Liberal. When you, if you read that book, you can't not be a radical after you read it, although somehow Thomas Frank manages, and he wrote it. But it just shows you the rot and said there is no two-party. It's all fake. It's all phony. The words that he said they know how to pay fealty to democracy,
right.
And they know how to pay fealty to liberalism, and but they don't. Then they do the exact opposite, right? Like Barack Obama came in power, and he made the banks bigger. People wanted him to break up the bank. He made them bigger.
Right.
He took us from two wars to seven. He made the Bush tax cuts permanent. He opened the Arctic to drilling whenever Shell Oil asked. Did it
right.
twice. There's fracking pipes underneath this country because he lifted the ban from the 70s on exporting fossil fuels. I mean, he's going to let it play out. He let cops crack the heads of peaceful protesters all across this country at Occupy Wall Street. I mean, there was no difference between electing Barack Obama and electing Mitt Romney. We would have got Romney care anyway. This, which is what we got.
And we would have been more critical.
Yeah, and people would have been critical. Of this, exactly. Like, so what I said last night during my stand-up set was that the silver lining of Donald Trump is that people are starting to realize the horrible shit that their government has been doing all along,
right.
But they weren't aware of it because Barack Obama is such a gentleman,
right.
And he would never disrespect a woman in public. So, like, you know, when the Muslim ban was the big thing, and nobody asked themselves, people all got upset, oh, you can't ban Muslims at the airport. And I'm like, well, why do you think the Muslims are at the airport? Why do you think there's so many refugees coming here? So it's Barack Obama bombed the shit out of them for 8 years and nobody cared. Does Barack Obama have to bomb Muslims at an airport for people to finally care about it?
Right.
You hear that Trump's putting immigrants in cages. You find out Barack Obama built those cages. You find out that Trump is now gassing immigrants at the border. So Barack Obama gassed immigrants at the border. And I guess they should feel honored that they were gassed by the lesser of two evils.
That, you know, that woman, that scary viral clip of that woman who worked for the Justice Department defending like not giving children blankets, not giving them toothbrushes. Remember these judges?
I didn't see it.
So these judges, it went viral. These judges were asking this woman who worked for the Department of Justice how they could, you know, with kids at the border, how they could not give them toothbrushes, how they could not give them toothpaste, how they could not give them blankets. And they were like, you're actually saying that this isn't a violation of their rights? And she's like, well, it depends. You know, you don't have to shower like every day, you know, you could go a week. I mean, it's unbelievable. And what's insane is that she was an Obama appointee and she's a registered Democrat. You know, I guess it's not insane. It's not shocking.
But this Russiagate thing has made people right. double down on their partisanship.
Yep, exactly.
I talk to people who are comedian friends of mine, and they're angry at Trump voters. I'm like, you're angry at Trump voters? You have to understand that we're all in this together, and that what made people so desperate to vote for a clown, and if you're such an opposition party, how did you lose to a guy who's a game show host? That's who I want to make fun of, the people who couldn't beat a guy who's a big piece of shit as that. There's really something wrong with you if you can't beat that guy.
Right.
That's a big problem. And so it's just amazing to me to see it's still people get caught up, and that's what Russiagate has done. It's made people double down on their partisanship. It's made them dumb. They say Trump is a divider. They're both. But that's what the elites want. They want us fighting left-right instead of top-down. And that's where the real fight is. And as soon as everyone realizes, you know, that's what Fred Hampton realized, which is why they killed him.
Right.
You know, class is such a taboo in this country.
Yeah.
In the media, we just don't cover it at all. We don't cover class distinctions in any way. We talk about left-right, Republican, conservative, progressive, reactionary. Yeah. But we don't do poor-rich. You know, upper class, lower class. It's just not part of the nomenclature anymore, or if it ever was.
Right.
And there are no working class voices really in the media, right? In the major media, are there?
I mean,
there
Ed used to, Schultz,
there's no
right?
Jimmy Breslin's anymore.
Right.
There's nothing, right?
No Mike Greco.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Even Stephen Colbert, to watch his transformation from doing what I consider to be the best political comedy show in the history of comedy to doing just another watered down Russiagate bullshit show. Did you see his interview with Tulsi Gabbard? It was just shameful. It's just shameful. It's just like
talking points.
It's just so he's like he literally said to her, "I think America is a force for good." And it's just like, why don't you just go home? What are you doing this show for?
Right.
What is the point of you? We need another rah-rah fucking voice television?
Wasn't that he was satirizing before?
That's what he became the character he used to make fun of.
Right.
And that's why it's so, I mean, again, it's just amazing to see these people I've respected and looked up to being better than me and just completely reveal themselves to be just as shallow, empty, and bullshitty as anybody. And I don't even know what he gets out of it. So, like, what's the difference between having $10 million or $15 million? Mm. Stephen Colbert is already Stephen Colbert, right? You're already doing a great show. What do you get out of going now to do that show, which is not as inspired at the most, which is the nicest way to put it.
Yeah, yeah.
Is that half as inspired as your other show? I don't know what you get out of that.
There's a huge difference between lampooning sort of power, conventional wisdom, all those things, and making jokes on behalf of it, right? I mean, the jokes just die when you try that.
Yeah,
Well,
did you feel a shift like when you started realizing that MSNBC wasn't going to save us? Do you remember feeling a shift? Do you remember it changed your relationships? Did it change your comedy? Going from kind of like the standard issue liberal to realizing that that whole left-right thing wasn't exactly capturing the world. Did it change the way you did comedy? Did it change? Did you lose friendships? I mean, I feel like
I lost friendships for sure.
Yeah.
Over Russiagate?
Over Russiagate.
But earlier, did you? So it seems like there's a couple levels. There's like.
There was the level of, well, I wouldn't vote for Hillary Clinton. That lost a lot of friends. And they shamed me. This voter shame. That's all they have. That's not how politics works. You don't shame people into voting.
Right.
And
I love when they're like, you don't even matter. No one cares about your vote / you got Trump elected. Like, if these people are the ones getting him elected, maybe you shouldn't shit on them.
I said, well, what I always say is that, you know, I did get Trump elected. I'm very powerful. And if you aren't nicer to me, I'll fucking do it again.
Well, yeah, that you can't.
So you better start
being. They need to choose a narrative.
So it's up to you. You be nice, and I'll vote for your perk hand. But if you're mean to me still, I'm gonna throw the election again because I have that kind of power.
Right.
So that just shows you that they don't really believe that, and they just want a scapegoat that makes them feel better. That's Deborah Messing doing that to Susan Sarandon.
My God.
That is somebody tweeted out, this is the equivalent of Charlie Daniels every day tweeting Benghazi's not going away.
Right.
That's when Deborah Messing tweets that. And
suddenly Susan Sarandon is like the most important person
in
history.
She's a sorcerer.
And it's just weird, too, because Susan Sarandon is such a major league talent as opposed to Deborah Messing.
I know.
Who's such a pipsqueak of an artist. That it's, of course, that's how it works.
You just talked about something. Sorry, I want to back up because I think it's really interesting. We don't talk about it enough. I got into journalism. Like, I was a writer before I was into politics. And one of the first things about writing is you want to get the widest possible audience. You're writing for everybody, right? Every time you sit down, you're thinking about everybody, right? But the modern media landscape has completely changed in that respect. Most of these shows are targeting one small piece of the audience intentionally. From the start, they're writing off half the audience at least, right? And as you say, it's sometimes 75%.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's a new thing, right? I mean, now it's suddenly actually a bad thing, right, if you're trying to address everybody. Mm-hmm. I mean, do you get flack for that approach? Or
I get flack for people saying I platform the wrong people, right,
Or you cater to racists, right? Or cater to racism. That, I feel like, is a part of that argument. Where,
yes,
if you try to reach people who don't already agree with you, you are playing into the worst in those people.
It's a point of pride to me that people come up to me after every show and tell me, I voted for Trump and you changed me. I voted for Trump and you changed
exactly.
me. Hey, I'm a Trumper, but I like you and I like what you say about the war and this and that. You know, I used to think, I just got a text from an Emmy Award winning comedian who I don't know, just yesterday. And he said, hey, so you're in town and I just want to let you know, I thought I hated progressives until I saw your show, but now you're honest and I get your point of view.
That's
and
right.
I appreciate your show and blah, blah, blah. And so I think that I'm more proud of that,
yeah,
I think, than anything. Because again, like, you know, we're not going to stop the war if it's just the progressives. You have to bring libertarians, independents, and conservatives. You have to get everybody together and stop the wars.
Right.
And you have to get everybody together and break up the banks. You have to get everybody together to realize that it's them against us. It's a class war. And, and we're fighting against a bunch of class holes.
You see that with Sanders, right? If, God forbid, he reaches out to people who may have been Trump voters or would be Trump voters, that's bad. He's catering to these people. And the solution...
Isn't that politics? I'm just so confused.
Well, it's not as it politics, but if you care about the victims of Trumpism, right, which these people claim to do, the people who say he's catering to racism or racists, if you care about stopping Trumpism, you want to reach these people and convince them to not vote for Trump. If you turn your backs on them and call them deplorables, what do you think they're going to do?
That's bad voter outreach.
It's a bad voter outreach. Exactly. And so I think that's so powerful. Like, that is what you're doing through your comedy, is, God forbid, you reach people who don't already agree with us. I mean, that you need to do that in comedy. You need to do that in journalism. You need to do that in politics, or else you lose.
I agree. And guess who's losing right now?
Right.
The country. The country's losing. But guess who's winning? MSNBC, CNN, The Washington Post, The New York Times.
And Fox. I mean, to be fair, they're doing the same thing. It used to be a business for nonconformist,
right,
iconoclastic people who dropped out of other professions because they had personal problems or just didn't get along with people, right? Like that was where you ended up. You fucked up somewhere in your life and you ended up in journalism. And there are a lot of people who are really good at the job who just, that was their personality, right? Now it's completely opposite. The people who succeed in this profession are just like you're describing, right? And it's so weird.
Why is that?
Because the culturally and professionally, the business has changed. That, like, you know, back
there's only
in the
six day, companies for one thing.
Only six companies, and you know, after like all the President's Men, all these sort of upper class kids wanted to get into journalism. A lot of Ivy Leaguers got into it, and they just started hiring.
Yeah.
You know, the people who used to go in were these kind of difficult people,
right,
and they're just not there.
Yeah,
like
people,
Chris Hedges, they bounced people like that out. You know,
that's right. So like one of the prerequisites used to be for being a journalist was that you're not looking to make friends.
Exactly.
Right. Yeah.
Exactly.
Right.
You don't
yeah.
really have that urge in you to make friends with people. Well, now that's all it is. That the whole everybody's friend. Chris Hayes can have a white nationalist on his show and say, thanks for coming on, you're welcome back anytime.
Which one is that?
That was Steve King.
Oh yeah.
The Iowa.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I watched that. My head almost blew off when he did that.
Right.
I couldn't believe. But I'm just glad I don't have to worry about comedy being, you know, is bad. No, first of all, nobody thinks comedy is important, so people don't walk around with that imprimatur or that feeling, right? Journalists
right.
walk around like they're fucking saving the world and they're doing something, and they're not doing anything.
And we can sort of close on this thought, but I mean, if you're in a position of influence, do you have to think about that? I mean, you know, your show is kind of stepping into the role that journalism used to occupy for people. People look to you. I mean, do you feel responsibility about that? Do you feel like you have to change your approach?
It's all fun. It's all fun to me. Like, the fact that no one else was debunking Russiagate was like, it was depressing to me because I couldn't commiserate with my friends in the way I wanted to, but it was also thrilling to me. Like, this is amazing. Like, I get to talk about this. This is exactly what I want to do. And if I do, yeah, I find myself kind of second guessing myself sometimes, and that's always a mistake, because the key to my success is that I don't second guess myself, and that I am a loose cannon, and that, you know, that's why people like me, and because people are sick and tired of the button down bullshit that they get all the time. And it's okay to be like I am, because I am a fucking comedian. And you know, the fact that I can do journalism better than journalists, right, doesn't mean I'm a journalist. It just means that there isn't journalism in America.
Do you think comedy is more failure like corruption proof than journalism? I mean, like, you can't fake a laugh, really, right?
It's an
involuntary. So you're either funny or you're not. Yeah, right?
I mean, people can spot a fake laugh.
Right.
If you're not challenging something with your humor, if it's not iconoclastic or brave, it just doesn't work, right? Does it?
Right. It doesn't break through.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
I never thought of it like that, but yeah. I don't. There's no way comedy could be as shitty as journalism for that very reason, because, you know, comedy still rewards the person who is the innovator. It still rewards the person who's talking truth. It does. It rewards. It also rewards shit too.
I mean, Dennis Miller.
You know, TV and entertainment. You know, mass media rewards bullshit often. Right. But
one last thing I want to ask too, about comedy right now. I mean, does comedy work if you don't have room to fail and cross the line every now and then, right?
Does like, not work.
So isn't it a very difficult environment for comedians right now? Social media is going to blow up on you if you go in the wrong direction a little
problematic.
Bit.
Problematic.
So are comedians playing it safer now than they have? I mean, politically, whatever. I mean, it doesn't matter. Like,
well, it's weird. It's like, I don't know if they're playing it safer, but it's like edginess gets co-opted immediately. You know, like, there was a time to be edgy, did rape jokes. Remember that? You remember that, Katie, right? There was an insurgence of rape jokes. And so it was people trying to out-edge each other, but then people just aping shitty edgy.
Right. It's like being outrageous for the sake of being outrageous without actually saying anything. And the whole punching up, punching down thing, right? Like, it's not edgy if you're making a rape joke, making fun of a rape victim. Mm-hmm. You can make a great rape joke making fun of rapists. I mean, that's a whole other discussion.
Right.
And George Carlin made this point, right? You can basically make jokes about anything.
I'm always amazed at how little advantage comedians take of their platform. You walk into a comedy club right now, tonight, you might not hear anything about anything. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
They'll be doing bullshit sex jokes or bullshit this joke or that joke, and if they do a joke, it'll be wrong about Russiagate, you know, or something like that.
Putin comes down the chimney.
Oh my God.
Right?
Yeah.
But at the same time, they have to get booked, right? You have to have a bar owner decide that. And you know what bar owners, I remember one guy said, I want belly laughs when the checks hit the table. They don't give a fuck. You know what I mean?
Right.
So they don't care if you're working on an artistic piece or trying to expand the genre. They don't give anyone belly laughs. They're selling booze and they want laughs.
Jimmy, thank you so much for coming.
Yeah,
it was great.
So
good. Good luck with your show. It's really cool.
Not that you need it, but yeah.
Okay. I appreciate it. Going right back at you.
So that was Jimmy Dore.
Yeah, that was.
A man who does not hold back. He does not,
not at all.
By this song, which is refreshing. And you've been listening to Useful Idiots. And by the way, we got it up to 200 plus ratings.
Did we?
Yeah, so keep rating and reviewing and subscribing. We got to beat Pod Save America again.
Fuck Pod Save America.
Yeah. Fuck Pod Save America, yeah.
Mike Carruthers shares little pieces of intel and interviews you can use to improve your life on the Something You Should Know podcast.
The next time you're looking for a job and have to write a cover letter, here's some advice from Skip Freeman, author of a book called Headhunter's Hiring Secrets. Add a P.S. to the bottom of that cover letter. That can actually increase the chances of that letter being read by up to 75%. Some people actually glance down and read the P.S. first.
Something You Should Know. Search on YouTube or wherever you listen.